blindfold or thongs. The man stood in the center of the suspicious ring of outlaws with the easy confidence of one who had nothing to hide. "Is this Daniel?" he spoke in a deep voice. "Peace be with you, my friend. It's been a long time." Daniel came closer. "Simone?" he asked uncertainly. He could scarcely associate his memory of a tattered apprentice with this tall, vigorous man. "Yoel gave you my message?" "I was glad to get it. You'd be surprised how often I've wondered what happened to you."
"So you know him?"
Roche was puzzled, but he signaled for the man to be released.
"The boy's been well taken care of," he said affably. "You can't deny that."
The blindfold removed, Simone looked Daniel over, with a twinkle of amusement that the boy was taller than he.
"He's grown, that's certain," he allowed. "I wouldn't have expected so much muscle."
"That's from the forge," said Daniel, flattered. "Did Yuel tell you I've kept at my trade? I'll show you."
"Later," said Simone. "First, I'd like some water, if you have some. You people give a man a warm welcome up here."
Chagrined, Daniel hastened to find the coolest water in the back of the cave. Roche left them, and the other men made a show of some business well within earshot. Daniel was clumsy with pleasure and importance. Never before had anything like this happened to him.
"How did you know where to find me?" he asked.
"I had an idea that once I got up the mountain, I'd have plenty of assistance."
"You might have got hurt instead."
"I don't think so," said Simone. He seemed very sure of himself.
Proudly, Daniel showed Simone his forge. He knew he had reason to be proud of it, but it was gratifying to see Simone's surprise. He had discovered, in his first year on the mountain, patches where the soil was rusty with iron. Gradually, he had learned to smelt it, constructing an oven against a rocky wall, lining it with clay, and devising a primitive sort of bellows from a pair of goat skins.
"This is very good," said Simone, poking at the lump of ore that lay cooling in the ashes. "No wonder you have muscles."
"Samson helps me," said Daniel, pointing toward the big man who crouched near the mouth of the cave. Simone started.
"Beard of Moses! Where did you get that giant?"
"He escaped from a caravan," said Daniel. "We don't know where he came from." With a long look at Samson, Simone turned back to the blade Daniel had put in his hand, running an expert finger along its edge.
"Not bad. Not bad at all. Amalek taught you well. Do you make anything besides daggers and swords?"
Daniel hesitated.
"Hooks, sometimes. We don't have horses, and we're not farmers."
"I see." Simone sat down on a flat stone, his back to the curious eyes.
"Are you happy here, Daniel?"
"Roche is good to me," Daniel answered. "Nothing like old Amalek."
"You always wanted to fight the Romans, didn't you?"
"So did you," said Daniel. "You all told me you are called Simone the Zealot. You ought to know Roche. If you knew him, you'd join him too." A sudden hope sprang up in him.
"Is that why you came today?"
Simone shook his head.
"I've known about Roche for a long time," he said. "I'm a zealot, yes. Roche and I work for the same end, but we don't exactly see eye to eye.
If you really knew him."
"Perhaps. Today I came only to find you. Amalek died a fortnight ago, Daniel. You could come back to the village if you like."
Old Amalek dead. Should he feel something? Pleasure? Remorse? Pity? It was too far away. He had not thought about going back for a long time.
"What about my bond?" he asked. "I had 4 more years to go."
"There's no one to hold you to it. He hadn't a relative to his name, nor a friend either, poor man. I doubt anyone would even remember."
Daniel tried to imagine going back. He couldn't tell whether he would like it or not. Simone let him think for a moment.
"Don't you want to see your grandmother again, and your sister?"
Daniel did not answer.
He was ashamed to say that he did not want to see them. But it was true.
"They have worried about you, just as I have," said Simone. "If you go back with me, you need stay only a day or two, just to let them see you are well. It would please them."
"Roche might need me." Daniel felt upset and resentful, as he had that day on the mountaintop with Yoel. What was there in the village for him but the old troubles that had ceased to bother him up here? In the end, however, he let Simone persuade him. Simone and his own curiosity. Roche grumbled, but there was an irresistible confidence about Simone that Roche admired. The difficulty came from the one Daniel had not reckoned with at all. As he and Simone walked to the edge of the clearing, a vast shape rose from the mouth of the cave and moved after them. Looking back, Daniel found Samson at his heels.
"Go back, Samson," he ordered. "I go alone this time."
He called Yoktan, and the red-haired boy jumped to an answer.
"See that he gets his meals," he told the boy.
Yoktan shut his lips tight, looking stubborn and scared.
"He won't touch you," Daniel urged.
"Just for one day, Yok. I'll do your work for you when I get back." Yoktan agreed sullenly.
"Anyone who tries any tricks will have me to reckon with," Daniel shot back over his shoulder.
But when he and Simone started forward again, the big man moved behind them.
"No!" shouted Daniel, angry now.
He waved his arms. The man stared at him without expression. Or was there an expression that Daniel did not want to see?
"You cannot follow me," the boy said.
"Wait. I'll be back." Then he turned and stamped down the trail behind Simone. At the first turn, he looked back. Samson stood at the top of the trail looking down. He did not move, and Daniel raised a hand briefly to him and went on. As they walked, Daniel tried again to persuade Simone.
"If you're a zealot, if you work for the same end as Roche, why won't you join him?"
"When the day comes," said Simone. "When the one comes who will lead us, then we will all join together. In the meantime, as I said before, Roche and I don't see eye to eye. For one thing, I prefer to earn my own bread and meat." The insult to Roche was like a blow to Daniel.
"Doesn't a warrior earn his keep?" he demanded hotly. "Roche would give his life for Israel. Why should the farmers begrudge him a few scraps? They owe him far more than he takes."
"Perhaps so," said Simone mildly. "I did not mean to anger you, my friend. There will be need for warriors, but just now there is always a need for a good blacksmith."
Daniel subsided into scowling silence. They left the rocky trail and came out on the road through the green pastureland that sloped down to the village. Presently, they reached a small ford that crossed a mountain stream, which gathered in a pebbly hollow, richly overgrown with fern and clusters of rosy oleander and purple iris. Simone stopped and studied the spot.
"This will do, I think," he said.
He began to remove his head covering. Daniel watched, puzzled.
"We will have to bathe here," said Simone. "When we reach the village, it will be too late."
"Too late?"
"It will be sundown, and the Sabbath will have begun."
Daniel reddened. How could he have kept track of the Sabbath? Had Simone guessed that in the cave, one day was the same as another? Simone, not looking at him, was carefully folding his cloak and spreading it on a bush. To Daniel's eyes, Simone had no need to bathe. Daniel looked down at his own arms, streaked with soot and sweat. If Simone had said another word, or even looked up, he would have abandoned the whole visit. But after a moment, he stamped into the fern, stripped off his own filthy tunic, and splashed into the pool. The feel of the water, after weeks of measuring it by drops from a goatskin bag, was sharp pleasure. Daniel scooped up handfuls of sand and pebbles and scraped his hands and feet. Then he got down on his knees and plunged his whole head into the stream. He came up dripping, to find Simone already dressed, sitting on the bank, and smiling at him. This time, he managed a sheepish grin in return. They reached the village just as the thin, clear note of the ram's horn sounded the first call to the Sabbath, signaling the workers to leave the fields. Nothing had really changed in 5 years, except that it all looked much smaller than Daniel had remembered. The streets narrower and dirtier, the dooryards shabbier and more cluttered. There were a few new houses with fresh mud walls and thatch still green on the roofs. He tried to recall who lived in this house or that one. They passed the shop of Amalek, so crumbling and out of repair that no new occupant had attempted to restore it to use. They passed the deserted square and the well where four weary donkeys were being hastily watered. They entered a dark, narrow street, at the end of which stood the small remembered house, its clay walls dark and crumbling, its roof sagging. Here, Simone halted. "I will leave you," he said. "You will do better to go in by yourself." Daniel looked at the house uneasily. "How do I know they..." "They are expecting you. I told them you were coming." Daniel glared at him. What right had Simone to be so sure he would come? Simone smiled a brief encouragement and strode away. Daniel stood, resentful, overcome with panic, and as he hesitated, the door opened and a very old woman stood on the threshold. How bent she was, and thin.
"Daniel?"
Could that quavering voice belong to his grandmother?
"Is that you, Daniel?"
"Yes, grandmother," he stammered. "Peace be with you." As he spoke, he heard the second call of the horn across the village.
"My boy, it is time you came home."
Her eyes, pale and clouded, peered up into his face. Her hands clutched at him. At the door, he hesitated, and the strong habit of his childhood reaching out to him, scarcely aware of what he did. He touched his finger to the mezuzah, the little niche in the doorframe that contained the sacred verses of the Shema. Then he stepped over the threshold. The room seemed to be empty. One smoking oil lamp hung from the rafters. On the mat beneath it, the supper dishes were set and the Sabbath lamp stood ready. He peered about him with dread.
"Come, Leah," his grandmother said. "You should not be working after the second call. Come and greet your brother."
Then he saw the girl, seated behind the loom in the corner, the long golden hair flowing over her shoulders. He stood tongue-tied. He had remembered a little girl. She was almost a woman, and he realized she was beautiful.
"Leah,"
his grandmother fussed again.
"It is Daniel. Come home after all these years."
He ran his tongue over his lips. "Peace, Leah," he said. The girl raised her head from her work so that he caught a glimpse of the clear blue of her eyes. The fear in them struck like a sickness behind his ribs.
"Don't mind her," the old woman said. "She will know you before long." "Shame, Leah. Get some water for your brother. Where are your manners?"
The girl did not move. Daniel waited, sick at heart. "Leah," he stammered. "Don't you know me?" he pleaded with her. "Don't you remember how you always brought me water when I came home to visit?" She raised her head again. Slowly, into the blue eyes, he watched recognition come.
"You really are Daniel?"
Her voice was faint and tremulous.
"You have been away so long."
"Please bring me the water, Leah." Obediently, she moved from the loom to the earthen jar by the door and poured out water into a hollow bowl, every motion gentle and graceful. But the bowl she held out to him was shaking so that the water spilled over. He took it awkwardly and bent to wash his feet. What had he expected or hoped? It was just as it had been when he left 5 years ago. No, it was worse. His sister Leah was 15 years old, and fear still looked out of her eyes. the last call of the horn came clearly, announcing the start of the Sabbath. His grandmother lighted a wick from the lamp and held it to the Sabbath lamp.
"Speak the blessing, Daniel," she said. "It is fitting the man should say it."
He hesitated. Then the words came falteringly to his lips. "Praised be thou, O Lord our God, King of the universe, who hast sanctified us by thy commandments and commanded us to kindle the Sabbath light." They sat on the hard dirt floor around the frayed mat, and once again his grandmother looked to him. Long ago, for the first months in the cave, he had repeated a blessing silently over his food. This he remembered well. "Blessed art thou, O Lord our God, who bringeth forth bread from the earth." There was certainly less to bless God for: a watery stew made of lentils, some coarse barley bread. In a moment, he noticed that the others were not eating at all, only watching him, their eyes following each morsel from the bowl to his mouth. "Do you not eat with me?" he asked.
"We have eaten already," said his grandmother.
But Leah was more honest.
"Grandmother said we must save it for you," she explained in her sweet childish voice. "She said you would be very hungry."
His appetite left him. "You must eat with me," he insisted, pushing the bowl toward his sister. With a frightened look toward the grandmother, the girl broke off a crust of bread and dipped it into the bowl. He saw the blue veins through the delicate flesh of her hand. The wrist was fragile as a bird's claw. Where did they get their food anyway? He tried to think how to ask. "It is good bread," he said. "Do you grow the grain?"
"It is pauper's share," his grandmother answered shortly.
He wished he had not asked. He hated the picture of his grandmother following after the reapers in the field, scrabbling for the sheaves they dropped, which had by law to be left for paupers to gather. After the meal was cleared away, they sat in silence. His grandmother did not ask any questions. Did she really care that he had come? She seemed too weary to care about anything. Her chin had settled into the folds of her mantle, and she drifted in and out of an uneasy sleep. He supposed she must still work in the fields of Ketza, the plant from which the village took its name. Stooping over all day, she sowed and weeded, and when the blue flowers had dropped, she beat off the seed covering with a staff and gathered the tiny seeds, so hot to the tongue, which were marketed as a seasoning for food. He looked about him. The clay platform which had once divided the room into two levels had crumbled so that it was no more than a shelf, scarcely wide enough for sleeping. A hollow scooped out of the earthen floor held the cold ashes of an old fire. The only furniture was a battered wooden chest and the loom at which Leah had sat. As darkness fell, there was a soft thudding sound against the door. His grandmother roused herself and let in a small black goat. The little creature went straight to Leah, who reached out both arms toward it. The goat nuzzled against her and settled down to sleep with its square chin in the girl's lap. She sat fondling it, twining the black hairs of its beard around her fingers, talking to it in a soft murmur, like the sound of doves on the roof. Daniel watched them, his uneasiness lulled for a moment. "She looks like our mother," he thought. Then he caught the words the soft voice was saying.
"You mustn't be afraid of him. He is our brother Daniel come home. When he milks you, you must be good and stand still. See how big and strong he is. He will take care of us and keep us safe."
Suddenly, he was afraid again. He looked away, trying to shut out the sight of her with her golden hair shining in the lamplight, trying to shut out the sound of that murmuring voice. Everything he cared about and worked for was threatened by that small, helpless figure. His arms and legs were cramped. The airless little house seemed to hold all the heat of the day. The sputtering oil in the lamp filled the room with a rancid odor. His head was heavy, and he thought with longing of the evening breeze that would be moving along the branches above the cave. With relief, he watched his grandmother lift down mats from a niche in the wall.
"I have made ready your old place on the roof," she said.
He took the worn roll of matting, bade her good night, let himself out the door, and climbed a tottering ladder up the outside wall to the flat rooftop. It was little cooler up here. Heat lay over the town like a smothering blanket. He sat for a time, hugging his knees and looking about him. "Why did I come here?" he thought. Already, he yearned to be away from this place. Hunger gnawed at him. Up on the mountain, the men would be still sitting about the fire, their stomachs satisfied with stolen mutton and grape wine, joking and telling boastful stories. Later, they would wrap their cloaks about them and sleep with their lungs full of clean mountain air, and the stars would come down, brilliant, close enough to touch. He wondered if Yoktan had made sure that Samson had enough to eat. He wondered how long the man had waited at the top of the trail. Suddenly, he flung himself on his face and buried his head in his arms and could have wept for homesickness. 4. The Bronze Bow. The Sabbath morning was very still. Not a grindstone rumbled. Not a voice was upraised. No puff of smoke rose from the clay ovens. No women passed on their way to the well. Descending the ladder to the house, Daniel found a handful of olives and a cold crust of bread waiting for his breakfast. The little goat wandered in the small garden patch behind the house. Very early in the day, when Daniel was already wondering how he would endure another hour, Simone came to the door. His knock sent Leia cowering into a corner. Daniel hastily went out into the road, shutting the door behind him.
"I'm on my way to the synagogue," Simone said. "I'd like you to go with me."
Daniel scowled.
"I haven't been to a synagogue for 5 years, he countered. "One more Sabbath won't matter."
"On the contrary," Simone answered with a smile. "Today is none too soon."
Daniel's lips tightened. He bent and picked up a pebble and shied it at a little green lizard that had crawled from under the house.
Simone's eyebrows lifted. Probably it was against the law to throw a stone on the Sabbath.
"There's a man I'd like you to see," Simone told him.
"They say he will visit our synagogue this morning."
Daniel glanced up. Beneath the words, there was a hint he could not miss.
"What sort of man?"
"I'm not sure," said Simone. "He comes from Nazareth."
"Good reason to stay away," grumbled Daniel.
Then, feeling the pressure of Simone's silence,
"A zealot?"
"It may well be.
Come and see what you make of him."
"In these clothes?"
"I have brought you a cloak and shoes."
Daniel stared at his friend. If Simone, stickler for the law, had carried a bundle on the Sabbath just so that Daniel could see this man, he must consider the matter important. Daniel took the cloak and went inside the house. His grandmother was nodding again in the corner. She looked up and muttered his father's name, her eyes confused with sleep. Leia crept forward shyly and bent to fasten the leather sandal.
"Will you go with me?" he asked on impulse, and could have bitten his tongue at the terror that leaped into her blue eyes.
"Never mind, I didn't mean it," he said miserably, jerking away from her.
Simone looked him over with approval as he stepped out into the roadway.
"How does it seem to be home?" he inquired.
"You call this home?" Daniel burst out. "My grandmother does nothing but sleep, and my sister is possessed by demons."
"She is no better?"
"Before I was apprenticed, when she was 5 years old, she hid herself in that house. In all this time, she has never stepped outside the door."
"So I've heard. The demons must have a strong hold."
"Yet she does good weaving, I understand. Your grandmother sells it in Khorasan."
Daniel had not paid much attention to the loom in the corner, but now Simone's words somewhat lightened his shame.
Who is this man we go to see? He asked, not wanting to think about Leah.
Jesus, son of Joseph, a carpenter by trade. He has left his work and goes about preaching from town to town.
Preaching? I thought you said he was a zealot.
He preaches the coming of the kingdom.
You have heard him?
No, but I have seen him. I journeyed to Nazareth with a friend who went to arrange for a wife. While we were there, this carpenter came back to preach in his own synagogue.
A town like Nazareth must have boasted.
They did not boast. They tried to kill him.
Daniel glanced quickly at his friend, his curiosity roused not so much by the words as by the tone of Simone's voice. But Simone had no time to say more. They were approaching the small stone and plaster building in the center of the village, and men and women brushed close to them on either side of the road. Daniel had to stoop to go through the low doorway. He sidled close to the wall, tensing his muscles, conscious of his shaggy height and his wide shoulders, trying to draw in and make himself smaller. But he soon realized that today there was no curiosity to spare for him. He was sure that the synagogue had never been so full in his childhood. Close together on the low benches huddled the men of the town, their knees drawn up almost to their chins. They sat in order of their trades, the skilled artisans nearest the pulpit, the silversmiths, the tailors, and sandal makers. Farther back sat the bakers, the cheesemakers, and dyers. And along the walls where Daniel and Simone had taken their places stood the lower tradesmen and the farmers. Still others crowded the doorway, and many, he saw, would have to stand outside in the road. By the rustle and murmur behind the grilled screen that separated the women's section, many of the men had brought their wives with them.
Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord, and you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your might.
The great words of the Shema rolled through the synagogue. For a moment, Daniel was caught up by them as he had been in his childhood. But as the long passage of the law was read aloud in Hebrew and then carefully translated into Aramaic, the language which the people spoke and understood, his attention began to wander. Though the throng of men sat respectfully, he could feel their restlessness also, and the anticipation that mounted, moment by moment. They knew that by custom, a visiting rabbi would be invited to come forward and read from the Torah. When the long-awaited moment came, every man turned to watch the stranger who made his way to the platform. The man's figure was not in any way arresting. He was slight, with the knotted arms and shoulders of one who had done hard labor from childhood. He was not regal or commanding. He was dressed simply in a plain white tallith that reached to his feet, his white head covering, drawn closely over his forehead and hanging to his shoulders, hid his profile. Yet when he turned and stood before the congregation, Daniel was startled. All at once, nothing in the room was distinct to him but this man's face, a thin face, strongly cut, a vital, radiant face, lighted up from within by a burning intensity of spirit. Yes, Daniel thought, his own spirit leaping up. This man is a fighter. He is one of us. Jesus received the scroll and stood unrolling it with reverence, as though he were seeking for some passage already determined in his own mind. Then he raised his eyes and spoke from memory. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to preach good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recovering of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed, to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord. A shock ran through Daniel at the first words. A gentle voice, barely raised, it carried to every corner of the room, warm, vibrant, with a promise of unlimited power. It was as though only a fraction of that voice were being used, as though if the full force of it were unstopped, it would roll like thunder. Jesus closed the book and gave it back to the attendant. The waiting congregation seemed to surge forward and hold its breath. Again, That voice made the blood leap in Daniel's veins. "I say to you, the time is fulfilled, and the kingdom of God is at hand. Repent and believe."
"Now," Daniel leaned forward, "tell us that the moment has come. Tell us what we are to do."
Longing swelled unbearably in his throat. But Jesus went on speaking quietly. A rippling murmur passed across the crowd. Others, too, waited for the word that was not spoken. What had the man meant? He had said liberty for the oppressed. Why didn't he call them to arms against the oppressor? "Repent," he said now. "Repent." As though that could rid them of the Romans. Disappointed and puzzled, Daniel leaned back. The fire that had leaped up in him died down. The man's voice had been like a trumpet call. Yet where did the call lead? Had Simone understood? Daniel stayed close behind his friend as the crowd streamed from the synagogue at the close of the service. "Is he a zealot or isn't he?" he demanded as soon as they had outdistanced the others.
"What do you think?" countered Simone.
"I couldn't tell. Why did they try to kill him in Nazareth?"
"They said he blasphemed.
Some of them said he had set himself up as God's anointed, a common carpenter's son. They were beside themselves."
"How did he get away?"
Simone slowed his steps. "I'm not quite sure," he said, "though I was there and saw it. I didn't know what it was all about, but you know how it is with a crowd. I ran with them, and I'm ashamed to tell it, I had a stone in my hand too. They dragged him up the hill to a cliff, and they meant to push him over. But just at the edge of the cliff, they fell back, and he stood there alone looking at them. I don't know how it was with them, but all at once, I was ashamed, terribly ashamed, of the stone in my hand. Then he walked back down the hill, and not one of them touched him."
"Didn't he fight to defend himself?"
"No. He was not angry. He was just not afraid. I have never seen anyone so completely not afraid."
"Strange."
Daniel would have liked the story better if the man had fought back. He was vaguely disappointed, let down as he had been in the synagogue. He scuffed along the dusty road beside Simone.
"I can't make the man out," he said finally.
"What did he mean that the day is at hand?" Simone walked on for a moment, his eyes on the ground.
"I don't know what he meant," he said slowly, "but I intend to find out."
At a crossroads, Simone left him. "I will look in on you tomorrow," he said. "Keep the cloak. It is an old one, but you may have some use from it."
Daniel walked on through the noonday heat, lingering to peer furtively at the people who passed. Though he shrank from their curious glances, he was in no hurry to return to his grandmother's house. Without warning, the sound of a trumpet split the Sabbath calm. Instantly, the peace around him dissolved into terror. There was a frantic scramble to be out of the road. Ahead of Daniel, two women and a child darted senselessly to one side and then the other. The younger ran back to jerk her child after her, the older woman shrieking at them both. Barely was the way cleared when a detachment of Roman cavalry trotted by, the horses' hooves sending up a choking cloud of dust. In their rear, four soldiers suddenly reined in, horses rearing, and stood guard. Some distance behind them marched a detachment of foot soldiers. Paralyzed with hatred, Daniel watched them. This was not the same as looking down from the mountain. Here, he could see them plainly. They were not even Romans, but Samaritan auxiliaries. Traitors, paid to fight in Caesar's army. He watched their brutish faces pass, one after another, looking neither right nor left. To smash those faces, even one of them. He bent and picked up a rock.
"Infidels!" he shouted.
A hand slapped down over his mouth. Another hand gripped his upraised arm and forced it back. He felt himself jerked flat against a wall, held fast, while two men stepped in front of him, between him and the marching soldiers. With the sharp pressure of their hands on him, Daniel's senses came back. He stood still, not trying to fight them off. He saw that they had acted so quickly that not a soldier had noticed. The detachment went on down the road, their laced boots slapping in unbroken rhythm.
"Gone," said a voice. "And no trouble, praise God."
"No thanks to this one," another voice rasped.
Abruptly, the hands released his jaw and wrist.
"Are you possessed?"
one man hissed. "One of those hotheads," the other scoffed. Another came closer, peering into his face.
"Who are you, boy? Not one of ours, that's sure."
Daniel looked back at them sullenly.
"I am Daniel Bar Yamin."
"Son of Yamin? Wasn't it your father who—"
"Yes." "Then you ought to know better. Do you want to bring the same curse down on all of us?"
"I despise them," cried Daniel. "I have taken an oath."
"Keep your oath to yourself," a man warned. "You zealots cause nothing but trouble. You'll have every village in Galilee burned to the ground like Sepphoris." Daniel knew he had behaved like a fool, but he would never admit it. He jerked away from them and walked scornfully down the road to the narrow alley that led to his grandmother's house. At sundown, the thin, clear piping of the horn announced the end of the Sabbath. Promptly, his grandmother snuffed out the Sabbath lamp, which had been burning ever since his arrival, and wrapped it carefully to put away for another week. The shadows settled closer around the one remaining flame in its saucer of smoking oil. With relief, Daniel perceived that it was time to take himself to the rooftop for another night. He was not sleepy. The long afternoon of inactivity had left his body restless. He was hungry, despite the sacrifice of the two women who had barely touched the food. He sat on the rooftop and felt the village steaming and seething around him in the dark, like a great pot of stew. He hated the stifling, foul-smelling streets, the miserable houses crowded close together. He hated this moldering house filled with the sighs of his grandmother and the murmuring voice of Leia. Here in the village, who cared about the dream of freedom? Even Simone was content to wait and talk, never to act. The man who had spoken, though, Jesus of Nazareth, there had been a moment when he first stood up to speak, when it had seemed, but it had come to nothing. More words, nothing but words. He knew one man who still dared to act. One of these days, Roche would show them all. One day, Roche's army would be strong enough, and then these timid men in the village would come scrambling to throw in their lot with him. And when that day came, he, Daniel Bar Yamin, would show them too. When the Romans were defeated and the last of them had gone, he would come back. He would build a good house for his grandmother and Leia, and there would be plenty to eat and a good life for them at last. And there would be no more giving way on the road and looking over their shoulders before they dared to whisper, but everyone would walk free. In the darkness, Daniel climbed down the ladder. He caught the faint note of a bell as the little goat shifted in its sleep. For an instant, he wavered. Would Leia be sorry when she woke and found him gone? Then he pushed back his doubts. Someday, very soon, he would come back and make it up to her. He walked through the narrow streets and struck off toward the hills. He walked swiftly, his feet sure on the rocky trail. Toward midnight, he came to the foot of the steep ascent that led to the cave. His heart began to beat strongly and joyfully. As he started up the last climb, a dark shape moved out from the boulders above, loomed for an instant against the sky, and then came soundlessly down toward him. In the dim light, he could see the white gleaming arc that split the shadowy face.
"Oh, Samson," he called out.
"I've come back."
5. The Bronze Bow. The month Nisan drew to a close. It was the time of the first harvest. On the slopes at the foot of the mountain, the villagers, men and women and children,
moved slowly through the fields of barley, the long hairy heads of grain falling in rhythmic waves before their sickles. From the mountain lookout, Roche's men watched them, speculating from which unguarded field they might snatch their own due share. Daniel, who had never before been discontented with a mountain springtime, felt restless. He chafed at the days of heavy labor required to make one inferior sword. He yearned for the day when they could cease to make swords and could at last put them to use. He was impatient with Roche's waiting. Every day, Roche's spies brought news of caravans passing on the roads below. When the men least expected it, Roche would give sudden orders, and there would be a spurt of furious activity. Then Daniel would hurl himself into the short battle with all the fury he longed to expend on the Romans. Afterwards, he always felt let down. What had been gained? Was the day actually any nearer? That night on the rooftop of his grandmother's house, he had seen so clearly that all he longed and hoped for was here in Roche's band. Now it seemed to him that most of the men did not really care, that they were just as bad as the villagers who thought no further than the next meal. He roamed the trails often in the hope of meeting again the boy who had climbed up from the village, though he knew that by now Yoel Bar-Hezron must be living in the big house in Capernaum. He and the village boy had been drawn together by a common dream, and for a few moments, Yoel had been very close to giving up everything he possessed to join Roche's band. Perhaps if he had another chance? Yoel was the sort Roche needed, impatient, full of spirit, not afraid to take a risk. Slowly, a daring plan began to form in Daniel's mind, and when he had mulled it over for several days, he summoned his courage and took it to Roche. Roche heard him out, his button-black eyes twinkling with derision.
"Ever been to the city of Capernaum?" he inquired.
"No," said Daniel. "Still, I'd like to try. I'm sure I could find him." Roche considered.
"Go ahead," he said finally. "You can look after yourself, but don't set your heart on that boy. He's got too much to lose. I checked on him. Grandfather was rich as old Hezekiah himself. But go along. He might be useful to us in Capernaum."
Daniel set off long before dawn, carrying the cloak Simone had given him. Leaving Samson was easier this time. The big man understood that he would come back. The dark trails held no terror. His feet knew every jutting rock and turn. With the first light, he left the mountain behind and strode along the level road through the plain. In the east, a yellow glow began to gather, sending out long spears of pink and pale amethyst. From the olive groves came the song of a lark, rising to a thin, clear sweetness against the pearly sky. On every side sounded the urgent chirping of linnets and finches. Abruptly, the sun burst forth. Daniel could see a golden field of mustard stretching as far as his eye could reach, the yellow blossoms so high that a man could walk through them unseen. Presently, he overtook a caravan. Prodded on by weary drivers, the camel swayed slowly. Above the smell of camel, Daniel's nose caught an unfamiliar fragrance, sweet and spicy, which seeped from the toppling bags they carried. As the day drew brighter, the road was busy with farmers trundling small wagons or bearing on their shoulders baskets of vegetables for the city market. Already, the excitement of the city quickened his pulse. He came out on the last long slope of the road. Below him lay the sea, like a great blue jewel in the sun, and at its edge, the town of Capernaum. A mass of dark stone houses, thick clustered. A transparent veil of mist and smoke hung over the rooftops. He fancied he could hear the hum of thousands of voices. He hurried on, forgetting the miles behind, feeling fresh and exhilarated. It was far too early to look for Yoel, but he was in no haste. There was much to see. He wandered through the streets, taking in great gulps the busyness, the color, and sound and smell of them. In the marketplace, The farmers were heaping squashes and cucumbers and melons, and merchants jabbered in outlandish tongues as they set up booths of cloth or baskets or pottery. He saw four elders of the Pharisees, the phylacteries bound to their proud foreheads, walking with great care that their tasseled robes did not brush the passers-by, lest the merest touch might make them unclean. Once he saw a black slave scurrying about his master's business. Did he, if Daniel could understand, speak the same language as Samson? He came to the harbor and gazed at the multitude of boats, fishing dories, and pleasure craft and flat-bottomed barges. Back and forth from the anchored barges moved an unending line of half-naked men, bearing on their backs the sacks of grain and baskets of fruit which the farmers had brought to the city. So this was where the food went that was borne away day after day from his own village. All this to feed the evil city of Tiberias, which Herod had built to the south and named for the emperor of Rome. Daniel was reminded suddenly of his own empty stomach, and he remembered that although Roche had been free enough with his advice, he had not provided a single copper with which to buy food. Further along the shore, where the fishing boats were drawn up, the fishermen were dragging in their night's catch, the great nets heaving and gleaming in the sun. Women had come down to meet them and were spreading the fish on flat stones and sprinkling them with salt. Others stretched out the empty nets to dry. Above the smell of fish, Daniel detected a tantalizing odor and saw that several of the families had lighted small fires and were preparing their breakfast. "Hungry, boy?" Daniel started, abashed to be caught staring. A smiling young woman in a bright red and blue headdress was holding out a small fish on a palm leaf. He backed away. "I have no money," he muttered. "Who said anything about money? You can see there's plenty. Take it." The fish was delicious, the skin smoky and crisp. The woman eyed him admiringly. "Where would a handsome stranger like you have come from?" she demanded. Embarrassed, he stammered the name of Ketsa. "Are you waiting for the teacher?" she inquired.
"No."
"You should, then. It's worth being late for work."
"What teacher?" he asked.
"The carpenter." "Ah, there he is now." She called over her shoulder to another woman. "Come, he's about to begin." Daniel turned curiously. A short way from them, on the shore, a cluster of fishermen had gathered, and from all sides others were leaving their nets. A few workers broke from the lines that labored on the barges. Through the shifting bodies, Daniel caught a glimpse of the man in their midst. It was the man who had spoken in the synagogue. He stood on the beach among the fishing boats, in his plain white robe, smiling and greeting the men by name. Out here in the sun, he did not look solemn as in the synagogue. He looked vigorous and confident and happy. Something he was saying drew a burst of laughter from the men. Daniel pushed his way nearer till he could get a good look. "How strong he is," he thought. Yet bodily, the man was no match for the sturdy fishermen who surrounded him. The impression of strength came from an extraordinary vitality that seemed to pulse in the very air around him. Once more, as on that day in the synagogue, Daniel felt a spark leap up in his own body. Looking about him, he could see the same spark reflected in the eyes of the men and women who jostled him. Someone shouted a question that Daniel could not catch, and Jesus held up a hand to ask their silence. "What is the kingdom of heaven?" he answered. "It is like a merchant in search of fine pearls who, on finding one pearl of great value, went and sold all that he had and bought it. Or the kingdom of heaven is like a net, which was thrown into the sea and gathered fish of every kind." A clink of metal distracted Daniel. Turning, he saw that two soldiers had joined the crowd. They sauntered close and stood looking with curiosity at the speaker and his audience. Automatically, Daniel spat. Two fishermen glared at him. Plainly, they resented his disturbance more than they did the presence of the soldiers. One of the Romans shot him a quick, contemptuous glance. Jesus took no notice whatsoever. He could not have missed their tall helmets, yet his calm voice did not falter. Anger spiraled up in Daniel. He did not want to hear any more. The nearness, the arrogance of those two choked him. He turned his back on them and walked away. Yet he could not escape the sight of Roman soldiers. They stood on the docks, counting off bales of wheat and vegetables. They strolled through the marketplace. Everywhere, the Jews went about their business, paying no attention. The boy who had lived for 5 years in the solitude of the mountain, nursing his hatred and keeping it ever fresh, could not credit his own eyes. How could these city people endure to be reminded on every hand of their own helplessness? More shameful still, he saw merchants joking with the soldiers. He could not understand. Where was their pride? Had they forgotten altogether? If Roche were here, he would open their eyes. Why did that Jesus do nothing? At the thought of Roche, he was reminded of the reason he had come to the city. It took him some time to find the house of Rabbi Hezron. Finally, someone directed him up the steep hill that rose above the harbor. As he climbed the cobbled street, his stomach began to clamor. He had counted on Yoel to observe the unwritten law that provided that any stranger who came to one's door must receive food and shelter. But as the crowded stone dwellings gave way to the long, forbidding walls of large estates, and he caught glimpses of gardens and terraces rising, one upon another, green and golden, he felt his first doubt. Roche had warned him that Hezron had inherited great wealth, but Daniel had no acquaintance with wealth. He had not been prepared for the hugeness of it. Would such houses as these remember the law of hospitality? Or would they turn him away like a beggar? He came to the heavy door in the wall to which he had been directed and rang the bell that hung there. After some time, the wooden door creaked open and a wizened man peered out at him. Hezron? In the nick of time, he noticed that the man's ears had been pierced. He had almost made a fool of himself and bowed to a slave. "I have come to speak with Yoel Bar Hezron," he announced much too loudly. With reluctance, the servant allowed him to step into a narrow tiled corridor. "You will wait here," he said. "What name shall I give to the young master?" "Tell him it is Daniel Bar Yamin, a friend from Ketzah." The hallway where he waited was cool and dim, the oaken doors that led from it all closed. Through the open archway opposite him, Daniel stared with astonishment into a sunlit courtyard, at flowering trees and green borders and white marble. His ears caught the gentle splash of water and the trilling of birds. He had not dreamed that even Herod's palace could boast such wonders. What a fool he had been to think that Yoel would even remember him. There was a soft footstep, a rustle of silk, and a shadow fell between him and the sunlit opening. It was not Yoel who stood there, but his sister Malthace. A robe of thin, soft material fell in exquisite folds to delicate embroidered sandals. Her dark hair was bound back from her face with a thin fillet of gold. She started at sight of a stranger, and there leaped into her eyes recognition, and then something else, an unmistakable shrinking. His careful greeting fell back at his own feet. She made no greeting at all, only stared at him with dismay. Then there was a thumping of feet. The boy who came charging across the courtyard had not changed at all. He was the same country boy who had jumped into the fight on the mountain road. He grasped Daniel by the elbows, his dark eyes glowing.
"Daniel! Welcome! I've been wishing..."
He broke off with a quick glance over his shoulder. "You'll stay to eat with us?"
"Of course you will!"
Pride battled with Daniel's clamoring stomach.
"No," he said. "I came only to speak with you."
"You're certainly not going right away, after all this time."
"My clothes are dusty from the road."
"Oh, that. Just leave your cloak here in the hallway. For Father's sake, you know." Daniel flushed, remembering that a common man who visited a Pharisee must leave his cloak at the door, lest he make the household unclean. Slowly he undid Simone's coat, allowing Yoel a glimpse of the torn and scanty garment underneath.
"Never mind," Yoel said hastily. "Better wear it after all. It doesn't really matter."
Propelling his guest along the corridor, Yoel was all at once aware of his sister, who stood still just inside the archway.
"Thasia?" he said, an uncertain note in his voice. "Do you remember Daniel? The one who..."
He floundered to a stop. Her fine dark eyebrows lifted.
"I remember,"
she said, in a cool, light voice. Then she turned on her embroidered sandal and walked away from them. Yoel looked after her with annoyance. Then he shrugged.
"Don't mind Thasia," he said. "She's putting on city airs lately. Come, we'll go up to my room where we can talk. If you knew what it's like to see someone from home."
Daniel had to follow so rapidly through the courtyard that he had only a blurred impression of green beauty. They passed beneath a row of slender columns into another corridor, up a flight of shallow steps and into a small square room. Apparently, Yoel slept in this room and did not even have to share it with anyone. There was a single low couch with a striped linen covering, two carved wooden benches, a painted chest, and a desk with quills and an inkpot and a scroll propped open as though Yoel had been working on it. Yoel poured water from a fine pottery jar and laid out a smooth linen towel. Self-consciously, Daniel washed his hands and feet and retied his turban. It was plain that Yoel did not care whether he was respectable or not, that the boy was overjoyed to see him. Daniel's wiry self-confidence reasserted itself. He would not let himself be shaken again by a silly girl.
"Did Roche send you?" Yoel demanded. "Have you held up any more caravans? What about the slave, the big black one? I didn't envy you when you let him off that day."
"I should have kept my mouth shut," Daniel answered.
"What happened?"
"The minute I took his chains off, he took charge of me instead. He's made me the laughingstock of the camp. He works like a mule to keep my fire going, but he won't let me out of his sight."
Yoel was amused at the picture. "Can he talk? Does he understand what you say?"
"The others don't think so. I'm not sure. Sometimes it seems as though he's trying to tell me something."
"You're not afraid of him?"
"Not for myself. But I have to watch him all the time. That strength of his,